Until a few years ago, Rick Bass was a full-time oil geologist and part-time writer. Now he writes full-time from a log cabin in a remote valley in northern Montana. Bass's first collection of short stories, The Watch, received almost unanimous critical praise. Bass's new book, Oil Notes, is a journal of his experiences working for an oil company. He writes, "Looking for oil is one of the few things in the world that is not governed by paradox. It's consistent, and you can count on it. And in general, a sturdy kind of man or woman does it. You live or die by your own lights. The rules always stay the same, though." I asked him to explain.
Pretty much the rules of physics and of geology have never changed the way rules of anything governed by sociology, rules for behaving in business or for behaving in even science. These rules change, or these boundaries, but the earth beneath us, it's the same as it's always been, and it's always going to be the same. You drill down and you'll find oil if you do things properly, and you won't find it otherwise.
Yeah, you write that it's thrilling to find oil, that it takes you over, it gets in you, it must be like belonging to a cult. I think I never thought that it would be that exciting.
Oh, it's the most exciting thing that I can imagine. It's unbelievable.
Tell me more about the excitement, because I think people think that the thrill of finding oil has to do with dollars.
Not at all. No, it's just the oil itself. It's like, that's like, dollars green are so boring, just paper, old wadded up paper that everybody's been handling and dirty and crummy. The oil is never been touched, it's never been seen, it's never been discovered, and you're the first person to find it. It's terribly exciting.
What was your best find?
I think the one I liked the best was one where we and some other companies that were in on the well were going to plug it. We thought there was nothing there at first. It was something we hadn't seen before, and we thought there was water down in the rock formations because it had real low resistivity, and yet the what they call the density neutron log was doing something strange that we had not seen it do before, and I was able to talk the company into trying to test it, and it turned out to be a really huge oil well. It was terribly exciting, because not only then was there the excitement of discovering the oil, there was also the excitement of having saved a reservoir that would have otherwise been plugged and maybe never found.
Do you get a commission on something like that?
I do now, because I'm working for myself. I wasn't then, which was a contention. That was I think it's a lot more fun if you're looking for oil for yourself rather than for someone else. I think it's that way in any business, though.
Mm-hmm. As exciting as it is to find oil, did you ever have an opposite reaction and feel depressed that you would be helping to deplete the remaining oil resources?
Not at all, really. I feel like it's the consumer I am certainly a consumer, who's helping deplete the resources. The places where I explore for oil, it's in the southeastern United States, which is all private lands, and so the people that are having the wells drilled there have asked for it. I would not want to look for oil on public lands. I would feel, like you say, I wouldn't even have mixed feelings. I would feel poorly about it, because there's people who don't want oil drilling going on their public lands, and certainly that's their prerogative. But no, I never felt that feeling in the southeast. That the landowners, that's why they gave us the lease, because they wanted us to drill there.
Mm-hmm.
And
you write that you hate coal.
Oh, I do. I hate coal. I hate it. It's so dirty. I would rather use. I hate wood. I use wood because I live up way up in the woods, and I don't have any electricity up there, and that's the only way to keep the cabin warm. But wood and coal, it's archaic, and someday oil and gas are going to be archaic. But I think we're going backwards if we use coal. I understand that that you can use clean coal and scrub it and such, but we're just not going to do that. I don't believe we have the discipline or the to do that. So I think we should just realize our limits and use oil and gas, which is the cleanest thing we have at present. And then when we run out of that, we should be developing other sources right now. That's kind of a melancholy or pathos of the industry right now. I think this is like about the last generation of geologists that we'll see in this country, and we'll have to go to other forms of energy in the next generation. And so it's kind of a swan song, and that makes it even sweeter looking for oil and gas, knowing that people, it'll be a lost profession probably in the next generation, if not sooner.
If looking for oil is so exciting to you, how come you left?
To write. Writing is also exciting, and I couldn't do both full-time. And I don't ever want to not be looking for oil and gas. I'll probably work in one or two prospects a year just so that I'm able to stay in it. I keep my maps current. I stay up with what's going on, but I don't throw myself into it the way that I used to. I try and throw myself into the writing now.
Now, while you were a full-time geologist, you used to drive 36 hours in order to spend 57 hours in the wilderness.
Oh, yeah, even more unbalanced than that. Sometimes I would drive longer to spend shorter times.
Now you actually live in the wilderness.
Yes.
Would you describe where you live?
Sure. It's in the small valley right up on the Canadian line in northwestern Montana. It's heavily timbered. It's like the Pacific Northwest. It's not so much like the Rocky Mountains. It's more northwest. There's extensive logging going on in my valley, which is disturbing really large clear cuts, but it's kind of like oil. You know, the valley won't be wild forever, but right now it's still pretty wild. There's all kinds of wildlife. We see bear and mountain lions and coyotes and wolves and deer and elk and moose come down in the backyard every day. It's like 100 years ago. It's a nice wild valley for now. The rivers are still clean and pretty.
Is the wilderness as exciting to you now that you're living in it full time and it's not something out there that you have to go to, take a lot of time to get to?
Yes, I'm glad to say that it is. It's still, every day it just gets better. It becomes more and more important to me, even the longer I'm in it, which is nice. You would suspect or think that, you know, maybe it would dilute or wane, but it just becomes more and more important to me each day.
Do you have an electric typewriter or a computer to write on?
I write in the greenhouse on paper with a pen, but I do have an electric typewriter, which I can run with a generator. And so whenever I have to type what I've written, I'll crank that up and run it for 2 or 3 hours in the evenings.
You have no phone, right?
Right. I've got a radio, but no phone, a shortwave radio that runs off a battery.
How do you communicate with editors, not only your book editors, but you've also over the years written a lot for magazines?
Yes, I really like communicating by mail. I think it's, for me, it's the best way, and it's the most natural way. I think phones and certainly these fax machines now, they're too fast. They demand too quick of a decision. And I think, you know, it's going to sound really old-fashioned, but I think it's almost an insidious thing that, you know, I understand that they're great life-saving technology sometimes, but also I think we can lean too heavily on that kind of high-speed living and let it alter our lives in a way we may not yet be developed for. So to answer your question, by mail when I can.
Where is the line for you that separates solitude from loneliness?
Boy, I haven't found it in so long. I couldn't answer that right now. I mean, it's a lot farther out there than it used to be. So I guess what I'm saying is solitude is becoming more and more important to me every day. You know, I haven't been lonely, and I don't know when. And you know, it would take an awful lot of solitude to reach that point, I think.
Mm-hmm.
There's so little solitude left anymore.
What's the worst trouble you've been in living in the wilderness?
It's a good question. There was one day that just stands out, very easy to answer. I cut my leg with a chainsaw, and Elizabeth set herself on fire within like 30 minutes of each other.
Gosh.
It was in the winter, and the roads were real bad. It had rained and then frozen, and so the roads were icy. I shouldn't have even been out, but I was down cutting wood, really just to stay warm because it was so cold. And I cut my leg with a chainsaw, not badly, but enough to really scare me. And so I drove on home, and I drove up in the driveway, and Elizabeth's standing out in the snow in her nightgown, and it's charred, it's around her knees or ankles, and she's just standing there in shock with her arms around herself. So she had been standing next to the fire in a cotton nightgown trying to get warm, and a spark had popped through the screen and had it caught her gown. And she saw the reflection at first of the gown in the window and thought it was my headlights driving up, and because it was right at dusk. And then they got larger and larger, and she realized that she's on fire, and she ran out and rolled in the snow. And that was when we said, look, we better shape up and realize where we are and take better care.
What did you do that day? Did you get yourself to a hospital?
No, mine wasn't cut that badly, and her burns weren't that bad. Mostly the burns were on her hands where she'd slapped the fire out. But if either of us had been injured badly, we would have had to go in on the bad road, which, you know, we have chains on our tires, and it could have been done, but it's just better not to do it.
So when you decided you had to realize where you were and get in shape for it, what changes did you make?
Just mental changes. We had prepared for the winter with equipment, you know, having backup generator, backup wood supply, backup saw, backup everything, backup truck even. But mentally, you know, not being tired, just being more alert that things may not always go the way you want them to go.
You know, I think it's a kind of nightmare of some writers that they're going to change their life, leave their job, and get to a place where they can write uninterrupted. And then they're going to get there. Now that they have all this time, they're going to find they can't write. Did you ever have that fear yourself?
I think my nightmare is just, I think mine's more broad than that, just that anywhere I am, I would not be able to write. And I think I looked at it, if I weren't writing, well, I would rather be in the wilderness not writing than in a city not writing. So I don't even get that specific with the nightmare. But And I suppose I would be happier. Well, I know I'd be happier not writing here than not writing somewhere else. And I think that's so I don't worry about that.
Well, Rick Bass, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Oh, thanks very much.